PFK. That's Mondays at 1 p.m. Honor the past, inspire the future. KPFK 90.7 FM, radio powered by the people.
You're listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and on the web at kpfk.org.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities, are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. Now to news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. The U.S.-Israeli military campaign in Iran continued into a seventh day today as the war expands throughout the region. Israeli airstrikes targeting Iran-backed Hezbollah targets in the southern Lebanon suburbs of the capital Beirut has caused an exodus of tens of thousands of people. Iranian missile and drone attacks continue to target Israel and U.S. military and diplomatic assets in the Gulf. There's no sign of the war letting up, as Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth warned that the U.S. air campaign against Iran would surge dramatically. President Trump, meanwhile, said in interviews with Reuters and Axios that he must have a role in choosing Iran's next leader. Trump spoke at a White House event Thursday with the Major League Soccer champions.
It's a country with great potential. It's a much better future for Iran. It's now beginning. It's going to be, I think, a great future. And the United States will ensure that whoever leads the country next, Iran will not threaten America or its neighbors, Israel, anybody.
Trump warned in the interview that the U.S. could be at war with Iran again in the next few years if the next leaders of the country choose the same path as Iran's late former leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who was killed in an airstrike over the weekend. Trump has effectively ruled out Khamenei's son, Mojtaba, who has emerged as a frontrunner to succeed his father. The U.S.-Israel war with Iran has led to the closing of a key shipping route through the Strait of Hormuz. That has resulted in the highest natural gas prices in Europe since 2023. European officials will meet today to discuss the war and its implications for the trading bloc. Ross Cullen has more.
As political differences emerge between different European countries over their response to the continuing conflict in the Middle East, EU officials are worrying about the consequences of soaring energy prices. The EU has built a number of new LNG terminals since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and more are being built in Italy, Greece, Latvia, Estonia, and Ireland. But the world's biggest liquefied natural gas production facility has closed, and the knock-on to consumer bills of global energy holdups in the Gulf could unsettle leaders already under domestic pressure. There is a highly controversial option of pivoting back to Russian natural gas imports, but so far only Hungary and Slovakia are considering that. Ross Cullen, Berlin.
Vote counting is underway in Nepal after its first national election since a violent youth uprising toppled the previous government. Election officials were starting this morning to count votes in 53 of the 165 constituencies. They aim to start tallying votes in the rest of the country by the end of the day. Some ballot boxes from remote mountain villages are being transported to counting centers by helicopter. Officials estimate the turnout at nearly 60%. Voters choose most seats directly, and parties fill the rest by vote share. President Trump fired Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem on Thursday. He also said he'll nominate Oklahoma Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen to replace her. Trump made the announcement on social media 2 days after Noem faced a grilling on Capitol Hill from Republican and Democratic members of Congress. Trump says he'll make Noem a, quote, special envoy for the Shield of the Americas. That's a new security initiative that he said would focus on the Western Hemisphere. Noem is the first cabinet secretary to leave during Trump's second term. Noem's departure caps a tumultuous and deadly tenure overseeing immigration enforcement tactics that have been met with widespread protests and lawsuits following the deaths of two Minnesota protesters at the hands of ICE officers. The Justice Department has released additional Jeffrey Epstein files involving uncorroborated accusations that President Trump sexually abused a minor decades ago that the department said had been mistakenly withheld during an earlier review. The department said last week that it was reviewing to determine if any records were improperly withheld after several news organizations reported that the massive tranche of records that had been made public didn't include files documenting a series of interviews conducted in 2019 with a woman who alleged Trump sexually abused her when she was a minor in the 1980s. The department said those files had been incorrectly coded as duplicative and therefore were inadvertently not published along with the millions of other Epstein files. Those are the headlines. I'm Max Pringle on KPFA.
And those were the news headlines from Pacifica Radio. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. Today on Sojourner Truth, we mark International Women's Day in a time of war with a fabulous double roundtable of wonderful, brilliant, international anti-war feminists who are joining us today. And thank you so very much for joining. Pleased to be joined in this first half of our show by Christine Ahn, who is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and founder of Women Cross DMZ, a global government, movement of women mobilizing for peace in Korea, as well as Hoda Kotabi, Iranian American community organizer, writer, and labor attorney. Greetings to you.
Hello. Thank you so much for having us.
Absolutely. So I want to start first with you, Christina. You were, you know, we talked and we were talking about what is happening right now. We both are folks that are working in the movement for peace and trying to figure out, looking at International Women's Day, thinking about how women and girls are so impacted, but so often not talked about, thinking about what we could do and how we could really bring some of this to the attention of this audience and of folks, hopefully, that are listening around the world. Why this crew? Talk to us a little bit about the folks we're bringing together and why this time.
Thank you so much, Nana, for having us. And it's so lovely to be with you and with all the sisters who have been on the front lines of trying to end U.S. wars and militarism all around the world. Why now? Why this crew? I really felt we are approaching International Women's Day. And I think about just about over 100 years ago when, you know, suffragists and Jane Addams and a bunch of international women, I think it was 1,100 international women, like took ships and trains and was there even trains at the time to gather at The Hague in 1915, right at the advent of World War I, to call for an end to the killing. And I fear that this U.S.-Israeli invasion on Iran is going to lead to a conflagration of World War III. And we are already seeing the implications, the drawing in of other countries. And it's clearly spread beyond Iran and Israel. And I just, I think the moment is now for a revival of feminist peace movements to call for an end to the insanity that we are witnessing today. I also think, you know, here we are Iran was part of the axis of evil in 2003, as the George W. Bush administration was justifying invading Iraq because Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. There was no WMDs. And, you know, I mean, it's just, it's crazy making that this government, and yes, I think that we're seeing a Trump administration that is extra unhinged, where the hoods are really off, the gloves are off, in a way that maybe Democratic administrations were had a little bit more decorum about doing this. But we are in a moment, and I think what we're witnessing with the ICE raids, the National Guard deployments, especially to cities that are predominantly communities of color, this is a moment where a lot of the progressive movements really need to put their focus on militarism, because militarism is the spine of fascism and authoritarian states. And we really need to call for an end to the US invasion. So why this crew? Because these are brilliant feminists, as you noted, who have been working to transform US foreign policy and to also do the hard work of caring for their communities and trying to bring healing to generations of trauma that have been impacted by U.S. wars, forever wars.
Thank you for that. And absolutely, thank you so very much. Listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumfy. That was Christine Ahn sharing with us why we need to talk with internationalist, anti-war feminists right now, as we look at International Women's Day and as we look at what is happening with this U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. Turning to you now, Hoda, first of all, you know that our hearts go out to you, to your family, to your country, to our siblings there in Iran and in the diaspora. And we heard a little bit in the news headlines, of course, from a certain perspective about what's happening. But we really don't get an opportunity to hear from folks often that are really connected to the ground and who are of the, you know, the land. And so give us an update, please. Share with us what is happening right now. What is the energy of folks right now? I would say both on the ground and in the diaspora.
Thank you so much for having me on your brilliant show, and esteemed to be among such great minds and organizers on this call. So thank you, and excited to continue learning from everybody else who has spoken and will be speaking next. But you're asking very small, easy to answer questions. I can start by saying that this is an absolute nightmare. And the first day that the United States and Israel launched a surprise attack on Iran in the middle of negotiations yet again, I could barely formulate sentences. I would forget what I was saying mid-sentence. Millions of Iranians around the world and tens of millions further within Iran were just in complete, I think, shock, and really just at a loss for how nightmarish this situation has been. I think that there are few words to describe really what it feels like to have just been watching and witnessing a genocide unfolding over the past few years on our phones, carpet bombing in southern Lebanon, and to be Iranian, having just witnessed thousands of your own people being killed by the Iranian government for rising up and demanding a more hopeful future for themselves, only now to be hiding from U.S. and Israeli bombs. So it has been really tragedy after tragedy that I think is really designed to keep us paralyzed and keep us separated and focused on separate issues, when in fact this is about a core ideology, a core militarism that is really has its tentacles in so much of our day-to-day lives. So I think as a high-level update, this is day six or seven of the U.S. and Israel's war against Iran and on Iranian people. It has felt like 6 to 7 years for millions of us. And this has been a really catastrophic moment for Iranians, because this has, in many ways, undermined decades of social movements like that have been flourishing within Iran domestically that have started about specifically women's rights decades ago, petitions to pro-democracy movements, to more recently revolutionary moments that women have been at the forefront of time and time again. And yet now, when the United States and Israel continues to accelerate its militarism against Iran, first by sanctions and then by actual all-out warfare, as is the case now, this has only erased and undermined so much of this work, so much of this development that particularly young women have been at the forefront on domestically in Iran, and has really given people a sort of hopelessness and a few options. I think a lot of people feel very stuck between domestic oppression and foreign imperialism, and happening at the same time is a very difficult position to navigate. And so I think that's primarily what's happening. In terms of the diaspora, I think that the diaspora is very polarized in this moment. I think that there is a minority that is very vocal, that is supporting the war on Iranians and supporting the rise of Pahlavi, who is the son of the deposed monarch of Iran, because many people view like they have no other choice. There's a polarity within the Iranian community of either the Islamic Republic or a foreign-backed coup from abroad that installs Pahlavi. And this polarity benefits only those in power. It benefits the Islamic Republic. It benefits the United States. And it all is at the cost of the Iranian people at the end of the day. So I think that there's very real wars, both on the ground in Iran and a narrative battle that's happening online as we're flooded with disinformation and misinformation, that the truth is really becoming a casualty of this war. That's a high level.
That, and we appreciate that, because we know that there's much more there. Thank you so very much. Thank you so much, Hoda. Something I wanted to ask you about in terms of the progressive movements and some things that were happening on the ground, because again, I think part of the disinformation that we're getting is around, you know, Iran as this, it's almost, you think of like a cave place of dust and caves, you know, that there is not people that are moving. There are not people that are looking for a different world, that there are not people and women in particular, and young women in particular, as you pointed out, that are at the forefront of some of those movements. Can you give us an example, right? Because again, this is absolutely not what we are hearing about when we're hearing about Iran. When we're hearing about Iran, it's almost always in the same breath as some kind of nuclear expansion, et cetera. It's not, you wouldn't even know they had universities darn near there, right? So please share.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think a great example is in 2022, I think what is might be most familiar to the audience is the Zandandigi Azadi, or Woman Life Freedom Uprising in Iran, that really articulated for the first time a real clear demand for a systems change in Iran that centered women, life, and freedom, and in a way that was not sort of a bullshit U.S., we're going to bring you freedom by bombing the hell out of you freedom, but a freedom of what it actually looks like to be free from capitalism, what it looks like to be free from patriarchy, what does it look like to actually live in liberation. The slogan actually came from Kurdish groups that were active in Iran that used the same slogan as an anti-imperialist liberatory slogan that was adopted after the killing of Mahsa Amini, who was a Kurdish young woman in Iran's morality police custody. So this was a beautiful articulation of what a world could look like. And there were songs and student uprisings and movements and really articulating what it looked like to actually live in a society that was liberated, that included an environmental component. There was, opening of journalism, newspapers that had been shut down. There was such a clear articulation of like what people wanted. And one of the main chants was against both the Iranian government as well as a monarch, Pahlavi. And I think that was such a clearly articulated demand that we want neither of these things. We actually want woman-like freedom. And I think that imagination and that imagery is so powerful. And I think contrast that to some of the first victims of Israel and the United States' surprise attack on Iran were over 100 young schoolgirls, ages between 7 and 15, I believe, who were killed and as some of the first casualties of war. And there's just watching the genocide unfold in Palestine, we know that Israel can both kill, is one of the biggest killers of children around the world, and also claims to have advanced technology that is great at being selective in who they kill. So how do these both exist at the same time? I think at the what's also, I think, particularly infuriating in this moment is I just heard that a senator from Alabama, who I don't respect enough to learn his name, has also brought pictures of Iran pre-revolution of women in miniskirts, the whole Afghanistan playbook. They're trying to rush as quickly as possible because it's clear the United States has no idea what they're doing and Israel is leading this. But he's pushing this sort of imagery of women's rights when I'm sure all the listeners know that what type of rights women have or lack thereof in right. in his state. And this is all being done by the Epstein class. This is all the sitting president has been accused repeatedly of raping young girls. There's no way in hell that anybody can take this seriously. It's the world's biggest baby killer and the world's biggest baby trafficker trying to bring women's rights to Iran. It's absurd.
It is absurd, completely absurd. And thank you for that, because I think it's important that people understand and know what is happening. You're listening to Sojourner Truth with me, your host, Nana Jumphy, and we are speaking with Christine Ahn and Hoda Kotabi, and we are so pleased to be speaking with them, brilliant international anti-war feminists, talking right now and been talking about what is happening in Iran, talking about the impacts on the country, the impacts on the diaspora, and particularly what is going on with women and girls and some of the hypocrisy that we see in this moment. And going to you, Christine, thinking about that hypocrisy and how we've heard that over and over again, and the need to focus on women and girls as we're talking and thinking about war, and we're thinking about militarism, as you said, is the spine of fascism. What are some of the tropes? I mean, there's a few that Hoda has talked about, but some of the tropes that are leveled around women and girls with respect to why war needs to happen, or even what the impact is, right? Because I think a lot of times the focus is on men, even as those who are going into war, right? And not so much on the violence that occurs with women. And we know that even as we talk about Korea, and we'll talk more about Asia in our second half, but as we talk about Korea, that clearly violence against women, violence against girls is part of the war conversation.
Absolutely. I wanted to just piggyback on some of the points that Hoda made. And I think this is a really important point, which is the kind of narrative of Western democracy going to build nation and bring liberation or freedom to the oppressed people is such a powerful farce. And in fact, what's so obscene about that is it's such so much the opposite, right? What happens, and I think Korea is an example where the U.S., you know, the Korean War was the front line of the Cold War, and the U.S. got involved on the Korean Peninsula because they didn't want the spread of communism. And what has since happened since that three-year war that claimed 4 million lives, mostly Koreans, it was the first war that American and Chinese troops fought each other. But what has been the lasting legacy of that war is the Korean Peninsula remains divided between North and South Korea. It is the most militarized border in the world with like 1.2 million landmines. It is the North Korea now has nuclear weapons. South Korea is one of the most powerful militaries, I think sixth largest military in the world with advanced weaponry. It is the opposite of liberation. It actually leads to greater repression, and more militarism doesn't lead to greater democracy. It actually leads to the opposite. There is nothing progressive about war and invasion. And in fact, what we see is the brutality of sanctions that in North Korea and in Iran has led to incredible suffering. And who is disproportionately impacted? It's the most vulnerable. And it'll be women that have to do the triple duty to take care of their families, to take care of their communities. And I think it just only serves to embolden the hardliners that say, look at this US military strategy, look at this US invasion, look at this like hostile policy, and it just justifies more militarism. And so I think that's what we have to see in the US since we are in the belly of the beast. And we are also witnessing on the domestic front, not just incredible repression and surveillance and mass surveillance, but the deployment of National Guard, the deployment of ICE. And at the same time, what are we also witnessing? We're witnessing massive cuts to the social welfare system. We can pay $60 million a day for this US invasion of Iran, but we can't pay for Medicaid. We can't pay for building a decent society in the US. This, we have to make that link.
Absolutely.
Nana.
Yes, don't know why that was happening. Absolutely. We've got to make that link, that divest invest link. We've got to be moving the funds. When we think about between the ugly, terrible bill and what we see happening with the military, we obviously see that there are trillions, really, of dollars that are going against care and into harm, and so little that is actually going into care. And this is something that we need to talk about and that we need to raise. What is one thing, and I'll start with you, Hoda, what is one thing that you think about that you want people to know about war? And to think about as they're thinking about this war, you know, beyond the obvious, we know that war kills, but what is something that you really think people should think about as we are pushing back against this US-Israeli war on Iran?
Wow, that's such a great and difficult question. I think the first thing that comes to mind is just how all-encompassing war is and war culture is and how it pervades in everything, so many things that we take for granted. And I think that that's both horrifying and also an opportunity. I think recognizing that the war is actually already at home, recognizing that what is learned here is taken abroad and vice versa, and that the industry and the infrastructure of war has made this country what it is. And so I think that the opportunity there is that we all have agencies and we all are here and we all have agencies to be able to build and learn and resist and collaborate together in ways that can actually truly identify the core of the military industrial complex. We can look at the fact that every single weapon that Israel is using to be dropped on young kids in Gaza, Lebanon, Iran, Yemen, and elsewhere is built by people who live in this country. It is transported by people who live in this country, designed by people who live in this country. And it has also, it's created by companies that also fly planes that we all sit in. So I think if we can understand that the war actually is here and we are a part of the war industry and there are ways in which our agency and our collective power together actually is such a key part in both the construction of the consent for and the destruction of the war machine, I think that that allows us to actually start to think about how we can build forward and how and what that looks like. That's one thing. I think one other very, very quick thing I also want to say is that I think oftentimes the left especially falls into a binary of either, you know, U.S. militarism or like a we fall into a binary where the country that the United States is fighting must be a country that we support. And I think that the same way that we can understand that the enemy of our enemy is not necessarily our friend, that Iranians should not be looking to Israel as an ally, Iranian people, because the Iranian government is their enemy, we too should not be viewing the state of Iran as our ally when it's the people of Iran who is with whom we should be building solidarity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so very much, Hoda. Really appreciate that. I know, Christine, you're going to be staying with us. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That was Christine Ahn, the fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and founder of Women Across DMZ, and Hoda Katebi, Iranian American community organizer, writer, and labor attorney. There will be more about war, more about women and girls, more about peace as we commemorate International Women's Day a little bit early on the other side of this station break.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some.
I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in, and especially thank those of you who pledged your support or renewed your membership to KPFK during this past fund drive. The support of generous listeners like you is what allows this listener-sponsored station to operate and to maintain its fierce independence. It's a very special relationship, so thank you once again for being a part of it.
This is Chris Hedges, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, heard globally at kpfk.org.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth Radio with your host, Nana Jumphy. We continue our look at U.S. empire and the impact of war on women and girls with a continuing conversation with international feminist anti-war brilliance as we think about and deal with the legacies of U.S. wars on the Southeast and West of Asia, looking at Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Afghanistan. So pleased to be joined now, joining myself and Christine, Halema Wali, co-founder and co-director of Afghans for a Better Tomorrow, and Danae Hendrickson with Legacies of War. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Nana.
So this regime, like many that have come before it, have claimed that the invasions that they're engaged in right now and that they've engaged in the past would be quick and contained. And you know full well how true or untrue that is. So I'm going to give you the opportunity to talk to us about the reality of how the people are still dealing with these wars that allegedly were going to be quick and in a hurry, starting first with you, Halema.
Thank you, Nana. Well, I'd love to start off with a quote from George W. Bush from April 2002. He says, quote, "The history of military conflict in Afghanistan has been one of initial success, followed by long years of floundering and ultimate failure. We're not going to repeat that mistake," end quote. And the reason why I want to start with that George W. Bush quote is because they launched an invasion into Afghanistan on October 7, 2001. And very quickly, by December of 2001, they claimed that they toppled the Taliban regime and that basically it was a great success. What we then learned 20 years later, after there was 20 years of war, 20 years of U.S. military presence in Afghanistan, $2.3 trillion later, the same regime that George W. Bush and his administration and, you know, subsequent administrations titled as terrorist, categorized as, you know, a regime not worthy of being in power in Afghanistan by essentially giving the keys right back to them. And what we know is that anything that the United States claims to be quick and contained never is. With Afghanistan specifically, there was never a plan. There was never actually a plan of how we would go in, but also how the United States would then leave. We then saw the outcome of that in August of 2021 with a botched U.S. withdrawal. Additional Afghans died because of that. And now that the Taliban is back in power, I think many Afghans wonder, what were those 20 years for? What were the 500,000 Afghan lives that were lost? What was that for? And what we're left with now is, you know, an economy that is barely standing. There is widespread instability, not to mention the impact it has had on young girls and women in Afghanistan. And so when we look at oppressive systems across borders, militarism, imperialism, they reinforce each other and essentially exacerbate global inequalities, and especially when it comes to women. So whether here or abroad, the United States does not care about women. One of the parallels that I see currently is, you know, government officials are using sort of this imagery of Iran pre-regime and what Iran could be. And then it reminds me of the Afghan imagery of a woman in a burqa versus when they were wearing mini skirts. And so what I think is especially important by bringing that up is that the United States does not care whether feminism flourishes in those countries or not. And as Huda mentioned earlier, the first thing that they did against Iran was bomb a school that killed a bunch of young schoolgirls. And so I think, you know, years and years of war, decades of war, just has lasting consequences, not only on the lives that are lost, the families that survive, but on the psyche of millions.
Thank you so much for that, Halima. Turning to you, Danae, because I know when people think about Vietnam, Cambodia, like it's in Laos, it seems so long ago, decades ago. Longer than me, longer than me. And I'm old as dirt and twice as funky. And it's longer than me ago. And yet, impact still happening. Please, I think it's really important that folks understand that, again, there's no such thing as small and contained as we're talking about U.S. imperial wars.
You're exactly right, Nana. And thank you so much for having me here to talk about this. And thank you for naming these as U.S. wars. I think it's an important part of establishing this as shared history and drawing attention to who is responsible for addressing the long-lasting impacts of these wars. Like you said, most of us are familiar with the so-called Vietnam War or American War in Vietnam. Many of us maybe have connection to this war, right? Through family that was displaced, like my own, or family that served, family that sponsored refugees. And so much of what happened in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia was done by the U.S. in secret to the American public, mainly bombings on civilians. To give you an idea of the level of contamination, from 1964 to 1973, American pilots flew 580,000 bombing runs over Laos, which is equivalent to a plane load of bombs every 8 minutes, 24 hours a day, for 9 straight years. Ben Kiernan published a research piece titled Bombs Over Cambodia. And in it, he highlights a phone call between President Nixon and Henry Kissinger. And Nixon says there's no limitation on mileage and no limitation on budget, anything that flies on anything that moves. And by the end of 1973, the U.S. had dropped 13 million tons of bombs and 12 million gallons of dioxin-contaminated Agent Orange and 8 million gallons of other herbicides on Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. So countless lives were lost, millions of Southeast Asians were displaced, and despite being the largest funder of global demining, the U.S. spent at least $50 billion in today's currency to bomb Laos over 9 years. So today, families living in rural areas face families living in rural areas face daily threats, even today, as they dig their garden, walk to school, build roads. An estimated 30% of the bombs dropped did not explode on impact, and so leaving nearly 80 million baseball-sized bombs in Laos. And it's safe to say that the brave women and men who work to clear the unexploded bombs will have to have work for at least, you know, the next 500 years. U.S. funding for humanitarian demining began in Laos in 1995, and here we are over 30 years later, and less than 10% is cleared. Each year there are casualties, and as you can imagine, children mistake them for toys, farmers striking them with tools, and at least 60% of accidents happen to children. When I was there in November, there were five boys digging for crabs in Laos, and they struck a cluster munition. One boy was completely blinded, another lost his right hand, and, you know, all traumatized. And similar stories happening in Vietnam and Cambodia as well. All the provinces in Vietnam are contaminated with UXO, and in Cambodia, at least 15% of their soil cannot be used for agriculture. And, you know, when I was there in November, I visited a fourth grade class, and they asked me questions like, why did the U.S. drop the bombs? Why is it taking so long to clean them up? Do you think Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam will ever be bomb-free? And to me, it was such a clear lesson for those that strategize these wars. They weren't thinking 1 second past the planes returning home. And the reality is these wars have impacted generations. Classrooms that have to learn mine risk education, farmers that have to risk their lives to plant their crops, and hundreds of millions of U.S. dollars that are needed to clean up the mess that was created and left behind.
It's a lot. It is definitely, I mean, thank you for naming all of that. That kind of destruction that is generational is what we are looking at with all of these U.S. wars. And we need only look to Afghanistan. We need only look to Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam. And we will look at the forever war in Korea in just a moment. But I want folks to know that they're listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. And we are speaking right now with Halima Wali, who is a co-founder and co-director of Afghans for a Better Tomorrow. We're speaking with Danae Hendrickson with Legacies of War. And we continue to have with us Christine Ahn, who is director and co-founder of Women Cross DMZ. The eternal war, I think it's important, again, when we think of Korea, so many of us grow up just North Korea, South Korea, North Korea, South Korea, that it seems like it's normal, and it's not normal. And I'm even hearing people talk about, oh, you know, Iran should be divided into a North Iran and a South Iran, and because of the Kurds and the who and the what. And, you know, when you hear those rumblings, you have to be concerned. So turning to you now, Christine, the forever war and, you know, how it's not contained and sometimes it literally is never over.
Yeah. I think that Most people, when they think of North Korea, they think of the North Korean dictator, the Kim Jong-un, and the whole kind of Kim dynasty that has been in power. But I think the question I often ask people is, I mean, what is enabling them to be in power and hold a grip on the country? And it's the U.S. I mean, it's the U.S., our military exercises we do with South Korea that is rehearsing regime change, decapitation strikes. It's the most brutal sanctions against that country. And it just justifies it's the kind of rally around the flag effect that it creates, that it just enables these kind of regimes to maintain power. I think two other points that are really important to make about the unresolved Korean War's legacy of U.S. militarism and forever wars is, one is President Truman at the time. Remember, this is the beginning of the Cold War and the height of American McCarthyism, is Truman didn't even, for a massive war of this scale, more bombs were dropped on the Korean Peninsula than all of World War II in the Asia Pacific theater, is he didn't even like go through Congress to get congressional authorization. He considered it a police action. And so I think that that's one, and that set forth, I think, this long legacy of presidential executive power to, and we don't, I mean, even in this moment, Trump isn't even calling it. I mean, yes, he's calling it a war, but there's a lot of mixed messaging coming from that administration. And I think the second point is that the Korean War actually inaugurated the military-industrial complex. I mean, in that 3 years, we saw a quadrupling of the Pentagon budget, and it has not gone back, even despite at the end of the so-called Cold War with detente with the former Soviet Union, with the collapse of the former Soviet Union and the so-called peace dividend. I mean, we saw minor reductions, but here we are at a $1 trillion Pentagon budget. And I just, you know, it just breaks my heart to hear Halima's story, Danae's story, Hota's story. And, you know, to bring it back to International Women's Day, I mean, one of the most tragic things that happened on the day that U.S.-Israeli bomb struck the girls' school in Iran is also the execution of that sister, Nana, you may remember from the Feminist Peace Summit, Inar Mohammed from Iraq. She started the Organizations of Women's Freedom in Iraq. And it's just like, how many years has it been since the U.S. like invaded and totally devastated that country, that it's still in such chaos and disarray that this woman who has for decades protected Iraqi women faced this kind of persecution. So we don't liberate. U.S. wars do not liberate. In fact, it leaves a toxic legacy, and that it creates greater harm, especially to those so-called people, women and children, that the U.S. is allegedly involved in these wars to liberate.
Yes, that liberation mythology, one that they use often, and we see, though, who ends up being so predominantly impacted, the women and girls they claim they're trying to liberate. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy, and we are coming close to the close of our special, special conversation as we head towards International Women's Day in a time of war, looking at, of course, the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, but also looking across to other countries in the Middle East, other countries in Asia, to talk about what war actually means and what it does to women and girls. And I know, Halima, you talked about the impacts to some degree in terms of women. Any specific examples that you have with talking about women and girls in Afghanistan and the impact that war has had that actually can still be felt today?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that was intended to quote unquote end the war were the Trump and US led peace talks in 2018. If you recall, the United States directly spoke with the Taliban government, I mean, sorry, the Taliban as a group, and completely iced out the government of Afghanistan at that time. Part of the icing out of those peace talks were women and activists. And ignoring feminist movements is deeply consequential. We see that time and again across the world, but specifically for Afghanistan, women were excluded as being part of those peace talks. They continuously raised alarms and raised flags that should the Taliban be put back into power, it would have deadly consequences for women and girls in Afghanistan. Again, we fast forward to 2021, where the United States essentially hands the keys of the government of the country back to the Taliban. And immediately we see the same thing that we saw in the 90s with the Taliban, what the a feminist movement in Afghanistan time and again flagged, is that the Taliban are increasingly violent against women. We see, as I'm sure many are aware, there's no secondary schooling beyond sixth grade for young girls. And a UN Women tele-survey from August 2025 indicated that 97% of women surveyed reported that the ban has had a negative impact on their day-to-day lives. And so that's not just, you know, young girls no longer being able to go to school. That's also young women professionals who had jobs across every sector in Afghanistan. So we're talking about doctors, nurses, lawyers, radio hosts, TV anchors, and beyond that, just folks that were working normal jobs, normal day-to-day jobs. And so what essentially is the like reward of all of this to the United States? Really nothing, right? Like the war started with the United States saying we needed to free Afghan women. And the war ended by saying your freedom's over, basically, and everyone's going back to, you know, the Taliban era of systematic and structural violations against women. Afghan women rights defenders to this day argue that the Taliban's systematic and structural violations of the rights of all women and girls are of the same character and gravity as the acts of apartheid that was criminalized under the Rome Statute, with the sole difference between being that the Taliban crimes are based on gender rather than race. And so there is a large, not large, but there's a growing movement of trying to get gender apartheid as something that's codified within the Rome Statute, because we do see violence against women in Afghanistan to be increasing, not only with the ways that they're shut out of civil society, but beyond that, the violence that is inflicted disproportionately against women for, you know, just walking on the street, let's say, in the wrong neighborhood, and so on and so forth. So I say again, the U.S. does not care about women. The U.S. does not care about freeing women. And time and again, we see that trope. And I do hope that more and more Americans at least can see the truth. And the truth is that women just end up suffering, whether they lose their children during the war, they lose their husbands, they lose their partners, they lose their many times the breadwinner or the source of income. It leads to poverty, it leads to disenfranchisement. It just becomes this snowball effect that essentially women and young girls are at the forefront of.
Absolutely. And in some cases, you know, lose their lives. Thank you so very much for that, Halima. Let's end with a round of what folks should do, right? One thing that, because there's someone who's a comrade of mine, Amy Castanel, that says, when we tell people all of these things that are happening and we don't give people something to do, then sometimes it triggers their freeze, fawn, flight, and often not enough their fight mode, right? And so let's just do a quick round. We only have a few minutes left of call to action. What are some things that people should be doing right now? I'm going to start with you, Danae. Oh, Danae, not sure if you're there. Let me go to you, Halima. One thing that you think folks should be doing.
Well, abolish ICE first and foremost, but also to push for gender apartheid being codified in the Rome statute.
Excellent. Thank you so very much. Christine, your thoughts on a call to action.
We got to keep pushing Congress to pass the War Powers Act. And I know we're limited by this Republican Party that dominates, but we have to go to the streets and bring our no war on Iran and no U.S. empire down with U.S. empire signs when we go to the indivisible No King's Day march at the end of this month.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Appreciate you knowing that this is not, you know, it's not easy work. It's not easy work when they change what was called the Department of Defense to the Department of War. So literally leading themselves more into a war situation. When we have a Board of Peace that is full of people that are intent on war and find ourselves in war to the east, war to the west, war down up north and war down south, as the great prophet Bob Marley spoke of, you know, we know that women and girls, gender expansive people and others are really going to be suffering. And we thank you so much as we commemorate this International Women's Day for bringing this particular issue in this time of war to our attention. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We will certainly have you all on again. Thank you for joining us. That was Christine An, Halima Wali, Danae Hendrickson, and Hoda Katevi talking with us, giving us lessons from the U.S. Empire's wars in Vietnam, in Laos, in Cambodia, and Afghanistan as the United States and Israel wage war in Iran and across the Middle East. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. One last piece before we close out, wanting to give people an update on what has been happening with the case of Ed Buck. Ed Buck, a wealthy donor that was living in West Hollywood, convicted in 2022 of the deaths by distributing methamphetamine to Jamel Moore and Timothy Dean, based upon the testimony of so many, including Dane Brown, who escaped from him in 2019. There was a trial, a civil trial, that was pursued by the mother of Jamel Moore, Letitia Nixon. That trial ended on Wednesday with a verdict in her favor, a verdict for the plaintiff, one against the Epstein class. And we thank her, we thank Jasmine Kanick, we thank Hussein Turk, we thank Attorney C. Lai for all of their work on that case. And that is our show. I'd like to thank our guests, especially Christine An, for helping to put this roundtable together, the Sojourner Truth team, including my dear sister, Margaret Prescott, our board operator, Ozzy Flamenco, and my assistant producer, Gary Scott, and you, for your continued support. Listen to this show once again at the same time and place next week. Sojourner Truth Radio, be well.
Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting...
Danny is an accordionist. He's dedicated his entire life to the mastery of his craft and to the preservation of the traditional music from his locality in North Kerry.
Broken Talkers Bellow, on March 20th and 21st at the Nimoy.
Feel it in my chest.
Bellow tells the extraordinary true story of one of Ireland's foremost accordionists, Danny O'Mahony. A man who has dedicated his life to the preservation of traditional Irish music and to the mastery of his craft. Tickets and further information is available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
It chimes with that. It settles that.
Hi, this is Michelle Coltrane. Join me every Saturday at 4 a.m. for my show, Awakenings. We will be taking a musical and spiritual journey into the world of Alice Coltrane and beyond. That's Awakenings every Saturday, 4 a.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and online for the world.